Okay, so last year we were talking about the specific type of challenge that was faced by Anshei Knesset HaGdola, that the shift from that, I mean, it's very nice, Moshe Kivil Tar Misinai, Masar Yeshua, Skanim, okay, that, all that's fine, but the real critical watershed was Nevi and Masarul Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And I tried to show you that, in, at least in my opinion, that was an existential change. It was just programmatic, of different people. And it's not a matter of the generations get lower. The truth of the matter is that there's a the whole question of whether we believe in such a thing called the decline of the generations is somewhat debatable. Because on the one hand, you have the famous story. Chazal say that if the earlier ones in Rosh Hashanah Kamalach and Manu Bnei Adam, if the earlier sages were angels, then we're just people, and if the earlier generations were just people, then we're like mules, and we're not even as good as the mule of Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair, who was a particularly intelligent donkey.
I love that comment.
What? Doesn't, you know, that's very nice, and it's true in a very profound sense. In fact, it's I was over Yontif. I was learning I was looking at one of the drushes of Rabbeinu Nissim of Gerona, who lived in the 14th century in Spain, and he, in his discussion of the chait of Miriam and of Aaron. So when God appears to Miriam and Aaron to give them chelek, why are you what are you taking on Moses? Don't you understand Moses? Totally different ballgame. Something we talked about weeks ago. So he also appears to Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Ran says, well, why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to be there when God's chewing out Aaron and Miriam? Especially since it might very well be Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what they said. You know, God knew. But, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu might not have known the rotten things his sister and brother said. You know, so why does he have to know? So the Ran says something very powerful. He says, because the way, for once in their lives, the way that God appeared to Moses and to Aaron and to Miriam was the exact same way that he appears to Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, God would appear to Moshe Rabbeinu, would communicate with him 24/7. It's one of the reasons why Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't have a normal family life. He paid a very heavy price. When you think about it, I mean, his whole family life like didn't exist. He left his wife. I mean, his. We don't think about his children, but we know that one of his grandchildren didn't turn out to be such a big success either. According to, it's pretty clear that his grandson became a priest of idolatry in the northern part of the country. I mean, you know, you pay a price when you grow up in a house of Malchus 24/7, and God could appear to him without any preparation. It's true that Aaron and Miriam were both prophets, but they needed to go through the normal preps. You know, they had to prep themselves and get themselves in the right mood, and they have to whatever a navi has to do to be able to have a nevuah, which at the end of the day God decides whether they have it or not. They had to go through. In this case, God appears immediately. So says the Ran. So what makes that possible? Makes that possible that God appeared to Moshe Rabbeinu and he let, who, you know, as you always did, boom, without a moment's notice, and he let Moses and Aaron and Miriam listen in. What do you learn from that? So according to that's the reason why I'm telling you this whole thing. So the Ran says the reason is because what happens is that when a person studies. With somebody, basically, they don't just get information from the teacher. Especially if you're talking about an Adam Gadol, somebody who's really unique, somebody who's really Gadol Ador. You are brought into their direct connection with Sinai. And that is not just educational, it's also experiential, or part of the education is the experience. And the further you get away from the original revelation, which is the one of God to Moshe Rabbeinu, you take a little bit of further away. The further away, the weaker it gets. So therefore, says the Ran, that's why you have that's where the doctrine of the decline of the generations comes from. That's on the one hand. I would mention I was just talking about this with yesterday. I was at a wedding last night of a very, very senior and very, 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 very important Talmid of the Rav, Rav Chaim Ilson, where he was marrying off his son. I was talking to a friend of mine who actually recently published a very important collection of the Rav Shiurim, and we were talking about, they were sure, it's interesting, he edited the Shiurim, I was there, I sat there, it was in the summer of 1974, and we were talking about the fact that I noticed when I went through his reconstruction of the Shiurim, and he had the tapes, he didn't need my notes or anything, or anybody else's notes, he had somebody else's notes, but he didn't really need them, I don't think, the Shiurim were right there on tape. He had to grapple with how do you convey a shiur in real time to a person who's reading. It's a very difficult thing to say. And so I said it's true. And there were some dimensions you're never going to get. I was thinking about this when I was reading, when I was learning the Ran over Shavuos. In his hesped for his father in 1993, Mariv Rabbi Professor Chaim Soloveitchik he's been grappling for years. What was it that had such a profound impact on the people that were in, especially in the Gemara Shir, in the Shir in the Yeshiva? Although this is true of everybody that ever sat with him. And he said that it wasn't just teaching, although the Rav was a brilliant teacher. He was able to teach little kids, at the same time he was able to teach the best of the best. He was able to create an atmosphere in the Shir of intimacy and involvement and of Yerushalayim that the way Professor Soloveitchik said it, is like the something you have only in very rare, sublime moments in theater, where the reality on the stage is more real than the reality in the room. And that's exactly what. And so that's exactly, you're in a different, totally different dimension. And in this case, in theater, the audience bonds or it loses itself in the action of the stage. In the Shir, you lose yourself. I mean, in terms of everything else that's insignificant, in terms of the Shir, and that's what the Rosh talking about in terms of the nature of the Mesira of the transmission from a Rebbe to the students. Anyway, so if that's based on that, the Rosh said that there is fact is his katnas adaros. There's decline of the generations. The problem is the Chazal were not unanimous on this issue. You have the famous statement: "Well, what can you do? Yiftach b'doro k'shmuel b'doro." That's true, okay? That you have to accept that you're talking to his generation because if that's what you got, as opposed to the people who had a Shmuel in their generation. But when you think about it chronologically, when did Shmuel live and when did Yiftach live? Shmuel lived after Yiftach, which means that things can get better. So I'm not sure how you weigh this. I do know one thing. When it comes to halachic truth, and that's what we're going to talk about today, there's no question that... that according to the Rambam, no such thing as decline of generations. The Rambam, in the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, says explicitly. He says that nowadays, he says you follow whomever is more convincing. Misha dat notaylov or dea notaylov bein rishon bein achron. When they live doesn't matter. It's the power of the idea, the power of the argument, the power of the issue that, in fact, is the thing that makes the difference. I'm going to show this off.
But in the halachic process,
yeah,
isn't there sort of, you know, these periods you've shown them?
So that's something else. The question. So here I interesting. I'm just going to say over something that I heard many years ago from the Rosh Kol at YU Rav Schechter, but he likes to go back on this. But this is also goes back to actually Reb Chaim. The truth of the matter is that in terms of what you're asking is the question of halachic periodization. Who has the right to disagree with whom? So here it seems like this. Okay. There is one or two. There are two. Two official. Unbridgeable watershed. One unbridgeable watershed is the ritual watership to Moshe Rabbeinu, which we talked about enough. Well, maybe not enough, but we for our purposes. Between Moshe Rabbeinu and everybody else. You can't disagree with Moshe Rabbeinu. It's called Torah's Moshe. He's it. That's it. Nobody, by definition, can come close to him, and therefore you're not allowed to disagree with Moshe Rabbeinu.
That's
period.
That's why
Moshe Rabbeinu
just simply comes.
And so, welcome Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah, exactly. And why Kibel and Moshe, all of those things that we've been talking about, that's dogmatic, no messing around. That's it. The second major shift happens sometime around the year 500, plus minus, we don't know when. The Gra says in the Gra says the Ber Gra in Shulchan Aruch that he mentions he quotes the Gemara in Bav Metzia, he's by Daf Pei Vav, Ravina Ravashi Sof Hora. Whatever happened when Ravina and Ravashi organized, whatever it was they did, and it's a big debate among scholars, among poskim, it doesn't matter. Once the Gemara is in place, okay, there's a fundamental sea change between before Ravina and Ravashi and after Ravina and Ravashi. Now, exactly what happened and what the source of authority of the Bavli is actually, I think, a machlokas rishonim. I think, or at least there are two specific positions that are advocated. So, for example, if you look at the Rambam makes it very clear. The Rambam writes in the second parak in Hilchos Mamrim, he writes that there are, if the Sanhedrin wants to make a gezeirah, they want to make a zakana, they want to do legislation, so there's a whole procedure. So first you set up, it's very Israeli, you set up a committee. And the committee is there to find out whether it's worth making the legislation in the first place. You know, he's doing sort of a, what's called exploratory committee. And then once they figure out that that what they want to do is something which the people can tolerate, then they bring it up to, then I guess they take a subcommittee to formulate it, whatever it is. Then they bring in Sanhedrin, then boom. Sanhedrin then votes. If they vote it up, or they vote it down. If they vote it up, that's it, we're still not finished. Then it's on, then it's sort of like, in fact, it's on trial. It's not unlike, what happens when they want to make in the United States they want to make an amendment constitution. Every amendment constitution has to pass by 2/3 majority of each house, but it's not finished yet. Then it's got to be ratified. We have something similar. Based on a series of Gemaras, especially Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Lamed Vav, Lamed Zayin. After the Rambam says, the second parak in Mamrim, that after they take their vote, then they got to go out and they got to see. If it's Pashat B'Rav Yisrael, if it becomes ratified and accepted by the majority of the Jewish people, that is finished. Nothing to do about it. For it to ratify, Partik, in order to overturn it, you need a Bezdin which is Gadol B'Chokhmah B'Minyan, who's greater in number and in wisdom than the Bezdin that enacted it. That's a whole kettle of fish, and it's, I think it's a fact though impossible. But anyway, it's not important.
Well, that statement implies this Dorosh process.
Yes, that's true. That's my statement implies that. Whether Rambam would say I was not. The question is number. What do you mean number? There's 71 people in Sanhedrin. It's another story. Okay? If it doesn't spread, if it's not ratified, so that's a whole to do whether it falls off by itself, whether it has to be set, has to be overturned by somebody else. It's another ballgame. Okay. Why am I telling you this? Because the Rambam, in describing the way that the Bavli became the constitution of the Jewish people, uses exactly the same terminology as he does when he describes the act of legislation by which the Sanhedrin functions. Pashat Barov Yisrael, it in fact was ratified, it was accepted by the entire Jewish people, that made it a constitution. In other words, it's a formal issue. That's usually the Rambam Shita. It's not so clear, but the Rif seems to indicate, and that the Bavli was accepted because it's a better book. Better than the Yerushalmi, better than anything else, that's what it was, and it was accepted and goodbye. We know historically that there was a world war going on, that the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael had the Yerushalmi, and the Chachmei Bavel had the Bavli, and they went at it. There were a lot of nasty things that went on. They were, each one claiming that their summation of the Torah Shebal Peh is it. In the end, the Bavli was the one that carried the day for all kinds of reasons. Probably because it's a better book, and it's also more encompassing, better redacted, whatever the reason was. That's even the historians say. In any event, so that's the sea change. Once the Gemara is accepted, Okay? The nature of Torah Shebaal Peh changes in the following sense. Up until then, everybody's playing on the same playing field. I have the same conversation, I continue the same discussion as, I mean, you know, Ravina and Ravashi, if you have these long strings of Gemaras, right, this Rav Shmuel says this, and then Rav Yehuda and whoever else says that, and then after that comes Rabbi Avrova, and after Rabbi Avrova, this one, it's all one long discussion, and they're talking to each other, and disagreeing with each other, and so on and so forth, and Ravashi can disagree with Rav, and nobody cares, and it's all wonderful. With the promulgation of the Gemara, that's over. You're never on the same playing field as that's the summation of the Torah Shebaal Peh. From now on, from being working inside the continuation of the Torah Shebaal Peh to basing ourselves upon it, from a participatory, if you want, equal same playing field as the Amoraim and the Tanayim, and now we are interpreting. As an Amora can have an opinion which no other Amora ever said. After the exception, except in the Talmud, everything, the litmus test of the truth stone, the touchstone of all halachic truth becomes the Gemara. If you can't prove yourself from the Gemara, you get nothing to talk about. That's all included. You're talking about the whole totality of the Gemara. No. The question you should have asked me is, so based on what I'm saying, then why is it that Tanayim and Amorayim don't disagree, that Amorayim won't disagree with the Tana? Truth is not always true. But the answer is, according to the Mechaber, it was sort of like an understanding. You know, that was sort of like in deference to the Tanoim, the Amoraim said we're not going to disagree with the Tana unless we have a Tana on our side. But in principle, there's no such thing. But there is a sea change. From, in other words, you're not allowed to disagree with the Gemara. You have to base yourself upon the Gemara. Okay, now.
The Amoraim did not look at the Mishnah the way we're looking at the Gemara.
They did, but they didn't have to. In other words, in terms of the way that the Gemara seems to understand this Gemara, it's the Ravina Rabashi Sof Hora, in principle, they didn't have to, but they did because they were deferential to the earlier generations and their greatness. Look at, you have Rav disagreeing with. Okay, fine. But then you have a situation in which wherever you have a machlokas between Rav and Rav Yochanan, we pass him like Rav Yochanan, and Rav Yochanan was nobody says he was a Tana. So that means that even Rav is a Tana, Rabbi Yochanan trumps Rav. That's true. Okay, but say it. You have something similar, by the way. We have something similar, by the way, in the shit from Rishonim Tachronim. What's that? So the truth of the matter is that here's a machlokas between me and the rest of the world. Most people tell you that the shift from Rishonim Tachronim, what's a Rishon Rishon Achron? It's also periodization. Who's allowed to disagree with anybody else? In other words, the same way that an Amora can't take a position without having backing by a Tana, and doesn't guarantee he's going to be going to pass like him either. But the same way that an Amora has to have a Tana's backing, so Achronim will not paskin without having Tanaim on their hand. In other words, they work within the world of Rishonim. Okay. If they don't have Rishonim on their back, it doesn't. The only exception to that rule is the Gra, because the Gra has, we give him the status of a Rishon. Whether because in deference to his genius, and B because that's the way he works. I mean, by him Rishonim like don't exist, so it's like a whole different ballgame. But that shift. Now, when did this shift happen? That shift happened, I think, most people say it happened in time of Rabbi Yosef Karo, like Rav, was a Tana and an Amora, so Rabbi Yosef Karo was both a Rishon and an Achron. If you take a look at the way that people write, okay, I think that even though that's the rule of thumb, I think that's not accurate. I beg to disagree. I think that people started acting like Achronim sometime between 1350 and 1400. Around 1350 plus minus, Ashkenazim start understanding the Gemara only through Rishonim, and they start trying to explain Rishonim, and they don't like to paskin among Rishonim, and they will not accept. And generally, and there's always exceptions, they generally will not accept a position which is not backed by Rishonim. The same thing happens in Spain 50 years later. You begin to find this around 1400. That's why I say with that 50-year period. So I think really that the Chachamim who lived in Spain and in Germany from 1400 on, certainly they really all they act like achronim. They don't paskin against achronim. They always try to avoid it being machri against rishonim. They start with rishonim. They live in the world of rishonim. They try to reconstruct what the rishonim, how the rishonim got came to their opinion, understanding of the Gemara. Their entire approach to Gemara is totally, or Toshav Bechlal is totally mediated by Rishonim. So that to me is an achron.
I think Moshe Feinstein had gone directly to Gemara's. Is that
true? Moshe Feinstein often started his discussion with going back to the Gemara, and I mean, like I said, Moshe Feinstein's. But he didn't ignore his achronim. I mean, he didn't consider himself to be like the equal of the Rishonim. He worked as an achron, but he went back to the Gemara. What you're referring to is something a little different. Once in the 18th century, once the Shulchan Aruch has been established as the binding code, which was also sort of ratified, sort of. Something which, by the way, they've only gone and fought very hard against in many ways. Then starts the question, okay, so we all accept the Shulchan Aruch, so what? Does that mean that if you start paskening a Shiloh, so we start with the Shulchan Aruch? And in fact, there are those who felt that way. The Nodeb Yehuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau, in the 18th century, had a Talmud. It was a Dayan, and afterwards it was heir in the Bezdin in Prague. His name was Rabbi Lezer Fleckelis. And he has two volumes. The tshuva is called Tshuva Mi'ava. And in the introduction to those tshuvas, he writes, anybody who starts before the Shulchan Aruch, it's a waste of time. Everything's all set. You start with the Shulchan Aruch, we go from there. In Lithuania, that was not the style. The revolution that was started by the Gra and then institutionalized by Reb Chaim Volozhiner and then became the whole yeshiva world was, no, we go back to the Gemara. Nobody's saying the Shulchan Aruch is not binding. But in order to understand it, so on and so forth, and in fact, you have to go back to the Gemara, and there's no ifs, ands, or outs about it. There are things that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say explicitly. There's all kinds of things. So you have these sort of like divergent attitudes. So in that regard, what you're saying is correct. In any event, so the question of being Rishon Ben Achron is not irrelevant to this question of the decline of generations. I mean, if you have the Vilna Gaon living in the 18th century, I mean, he was greater than people lived before him. In fact, Professor Schneer Lyman says that he once observed, he said the 18th century is one of these periods when the Jewish world was like filled with Gedolim, with just genius. You have these eras, like the 12th century was like that, and the 16th century was like that. The late 19th, early 20th century was like that. The 18th century was like that also. Unfortunately, you have geniuses who, if they were lived at any other time, they would have like been like the stars of heaven. Unfortunately, they live at the same. When you live at the same time as the Vilna Gaon and Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you sort of fade in luster as a result. One of the Rebbeim at YU once told a friend of mine that yeshiva at the time of the Rav Soloveitchik was there was sort of like a forest with one big tree and lots of little trees. And the problem is that the big tree gets all the light and all the water and all the little trees, they don't get to really to grow. So anyway, in any event. So even though it wasn't that radical a shift, there was a major shift in terms of the conditions under which they had to work from the time in the Nevi'im, who were the end of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, to the time of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, the absence of prophecy, and we saw examples of that, a few hundred years after the disappearance, a couple of year hundred years, no, 200 years after the disappearance of prophecy, or 250 years, they're still saying, well, we'll do this until the Nevi'im come back. You know, there's sort of like tentativeness about things, which I think is the reason why. And when you think about what they had to do, they established new holidays, and they set up the entire system of brachos, tefillos, and abdolos. And I mean, they were very busy. I mean, they would had to do things which were unprecedented. And I think that was part of the, I mean, trauma, if you want to know the truth. And we'll get to it's something else we'll get to in a sec. And that's why I think That's why I think you can understand the initial upshot before the portion. Just look at the Mishnah. The initial upshot of the three things that they are reputed to have said. Do you want to have this Mishnah is over there in the corner? I mean, what did they say? Havu metunin badin. Right in front of you. Be deliberate. Matun generally by us means moderate, but be deliberate in bedin. Okay, what exactly din is we don't know. V'hamir talmi miharbe. You should have a lot of students. V'asu siag v'torah, and you should make a fence around the Torah. So havu metunin badin. Look at if you are Anshei Kesed HaGedolah and you're doing stuff and everything you do is unparalleled and everything you do is under circumstances which are have never existed before. So you're going to be very, very cautious and very deliberate. You're not going to rush in and do anything. We're going to come back to this. Okay? Hamida Talmidim Harbe, same thing. If the Gadol HaDor is also the Navi, so all you need is the Navi. You go sending the thing to Zechariah and goodbye. But if Torah is now based on study and under an independent taking responsibility and so on, then you have to get the message out. You have to be more diffuse than you would be previously. Vasusiag la Torah, we'll see I hope to show that also fits in, but we'll see further. Now, I want to concentrate today on Havu Metunin Badin. What does that mean? What does Havu Metunin Badin, be deliberate in justice and judgment, mean? So all the Muslim Mefarshim I saw say, so they all say more or less the same thing, don't rush to judgment. Wasn't that a book? It was a movie or something, Rush to Judgment? It was in favor of the Rosenbergs, it turns out they were both guilty, or at least he was guilty. But in any way, don't rush to judgment. However, there's an entire line of interpretation of this Mishnah which speaks to precisely the way Psak Halach is supposed to work and how it's not supposed to work. Okay? Havu Metunin Badin, on one hand, assumes that you shouldn't go rush to answer. The Rav thought that this was not just it's a good advice to everybody, don't rush to judgment. The Rav thought that really that this was an issue of how a Rav should go about paskening a Shaila. The point of departure for that is the Gemara these Gemaras that I brought here. Tanya Rabbi Elazar Omer, it's actually a bracelet that we've seen before. Hamispalach Orei Rabbo. If you're daven behind your Rebbe or your teacher, but no saying shalom l'rabbo. Now, obviously, you can say hello to your teacher. If you call him Jack, however, that's what we're talking about. V'amazir shalom l'rabbo, same deal. V'cholek al yeshivaso shel rabbo, and you disagree publicly with your with the consensus of your teacher's academy. We'll see that has to be carefully nuanced. That's not 100%. It shouldn't take this literally. Va'omer davar shaloshama mipi rabo. And if you heard something which you didn't hear from your teacher, gorin l'shchina shetisal g'misrabo. We saw, but the point is, the Rabbi Lezer's point is, you always have to defer. Your teacher is your teacher, and so on. Okay. The Gemara then adds, the Sanhedrin dav chesam beis. Tana, ba'osu shah gazru, it's a whole story I don't want to go into right now. Talmud al yore elim kain no tel rishus mirabba. You're not allowed to paskin in front of your Rebbe. And in fact, you shouldn't paskin at all until you get permission. Okay? That is essentially what smicha is today. The smicha that rabbis get today doesn't imbue you with powers to adjudicate all kinds of areas of halacha which have fallen into abeyance. I mean, the possibility of restoring that periodically pops up. The Rambam suggested in the 1170s, and then in the 1600s they try to restart the Sanhedrin in Tzvat, and now we have the Sanhedrin that's based in Tveria with all kinds of interesting people. I think Rav Steinsaltz was the head of it, or no, it was not.
Supposed to be ordered, I think.
We're
only talking the world of halacha.
Right? Well, right now we're talking about halacha.
Let me.
That's a very complicated business. I will tell you straight off. I do the I do not accept the idea of the contemporary parlance that that a rabbi can get up and talk about what he doesn't know about and then say that's Death Star.
But if he did, and he's your teacher, what do you do with that? What can you do?
The question is, what is the Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a long essay he recently, it's not an essay, it's a sicha he gave. A person who's a real gadol b'Torah should have an opinion on any given topic. Whether that is binding the same way that psak halacha that you ask him is, that requires more careful examination. Listen, especially if you don't ask. You know, I mean, if you ask, Mela, but if you don't ask, to tell you who to vote for, I mean, to tell you, it's not, it's very...
No, because we see a lot of this
in Israel. Yeah, the concept of Das Torah or Munis Chachamim, the way that it's used today, is not documented before the 19th century. Doesn't. When you look at what a Munis Chachamim means, believing in the credibility of Chachamim, most Meforshim, all the Tzatzit, in the so-called sixth Perkei Avos, it means you accept the integrity of the Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Rambam says, for example, that a person who has no Chalek Haba is a person who is kafir b'Torah Shebaal Peh that exists. V'makchish magideha, that you reject or you besmirch the integrity of those who are the Mosrei HaMasora. That you get a lot today also. I mean, I had I really spent too much time with this. But there is a group on Facebook called Ani Feministit Datit Veli Gamli Ein Chush Humor. And it's a lot of frustrated with religious feminists. Some, I'm not so sure how religious some of them are, but anyways. The kinds of things, one woman wrote something like, I'm sick and tired of, I don't want to hear any more about Balaniyot and Nanksamim and Tuma and Nida, it's ridiculous and stupid and call it a day. That's right. Alright, so she can scream and yell. The responses that people gave are exactly this Makrish Magideha. The rabbis were prejudiced, the rabbis were misogynist, the rabbis hated women, that's a Makrish Magideha, but that's when the Mishnah says you're supposed to have Emunas Chachamim, it's duck against that that we're talking about. We're not talking about if the rabbi gets up and says you gotta vote for Aguda, that you gotta vote for Aguda. Now, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, it would be, I think it's illegitimate not to consult and not to have rabbinic involvement in public policy, but
this allows us to go against, let's say, the Rambam on medical issues.
So there you have something else. So that's an interesting question. So that comes to the question of, that was the whole Slutkin affair, whether we pass like the Rambam or not. The Rambam, this is clearly it's the Rambam. As long as I'm here. He actually was my student for a short period of time. Where's the other? I need Aleph. This Aleph? Where's Aleph? Yeah. The Rabbi Rambam Arambam was the Rambam's only son. Rambam may have had a daughter, but it's not clear. All descendants, to the best of my knowledge, all descendants are presently living descendants of the Rambam, and there are such people. One of them was the chief rabbi of Seattle for many years, Rabbi Maimon. Descended from Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam. Rabbi Rambam was 17 when the Rambam died. He was his Talmud Milvak. So Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam wrote a book called Kafayat al Abadin, that which is required for the those who serve God. And in the introduction, this is published in all the very religious editions of Ein Yaakov. It's also published in a better edition by Rabbi Reuven Margoliot, who was an interesting man by himself. Rabbi Reuven Margoliot was he and his wife, he lived in Tel Aviv, he had no children. He was the librarian of the Rambam Library in Tel Aviv, which is an amazing research library, and he wrote an incredible swarm. He's probably best known for Shulchan Sanhedrin with Margoliath Hayam. He wrote the Margoliath Hayam. He's the one that wrote the Perush on Sefer Hasidim, the edition was put up by Moshe Rav Kook, and all kinds of a zillion little swarm. They're really wonderful because he was a tremendous friend of Bucky. Anyway, so he wrote one he has one volume called Milchamot Hashem, in which he put together some of Rav Avraham ben Rambam's writings, largely about the Maimonidean controversy of the 1230s, which he was tangentially involved with, even though most of the action when they were fighting over the Rambam and ended up turning it over to the Inquisition to be burned in 1233, what happened in France and in Spain, there were sort of echoes in Egypt too. In any event, he wrote a thing called Ma'amar Alodot Drashot Chazal. A letter or sort of an article about the an essay about the Chazal's drashas. He writes, how do you deal with all kinds of things that are difficult to understand in Chazal? So I'm just going to read you the important line. It's a very long essay, as you can see. It's translated from the Arabic. He writes, "Da, you should know. Ki ata chayav l'da. It's important for a person to know. Kol mi sheyirta lahamid deya yidu. If you want to establish or prove a well-known opinion, and to actually to prefer or to accept the authority of the person who said it, will kabel dato beli iyun, and to accept that person's opinion beli iyun vahavana leinyano todaya, without checking it out, without seeing, you know, actually looking to see if the thing makes sense or not, whether it really makes it sense. You're saying no, but I'm accepting because he said so. That is a very bad moral quality. Here the Rambam, he has used the word deyot in the sense that the Rambam has hilchot deyot, which quality, ethics, whatever the Rambam means there. He says, and such an action is prohibited by the Torah, and it's also makes no sense rationally. And when you consider the fact that there were two paths to truth according to the Rambam, one derech haseichel, one derech haTorah, and the two are identical, so it's basically saying that both ways that God, both of the paths by which God makes His will known, prohibit such behavior. Ve'eino roi miderech haseichel. It's not appropriate. It's not acceptable from a rational point of view. Because it assumes, you know, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. You can't know such a thing. You can't just so he said. It's like, you know, they say in Yiddish, it's a gezocht. So he said. So what? You don't know. Okay. He says that's not proper. Umiderech haTorah. He says it's not appropriate from the Torah's point of view. Mipnei notem miderech haemet, v'notem mi al kav yashar, because it deviates from the path of established truth, and deviates from the straight and narrow. Why? Amar Hashem Yitbarech, because God said, Lo tisah penei dal v'no tet dar penei gadol b'tzedek tishpot amitecha. The Torah says that it's a business that if you're a dayan, two guys come in front of you, and one is the gvir in the town, and the other one is the schlepper, so don't paskin like the schlepper or the poor guy because you have rachmanis, and don't paskin like the big shot because he's the big shot. You gotta be, as we say in Hebrew, in Yanni, you've gotta deal with the point the way it is. Lo takira panim b'mishpat, same deal. The Torah says it twice. And he says, and there's no difference. There's no difference if you accept something without any proof. Or we say, well, he must know what he's talking about because he's smarter than me. You can't say that. That's not the way it works. And he has all kinds of proofs. And as a result, he says, therefore. Based on this prior premise. Now, obviously, if you don't know, if you're not an expert in what the person's talking about, then you have to rely on somebody. Nobody's going to, if I go to my cardiologist and he tells me I got to do X, I'm not going to say I won't accept what you're saying. Might be better to do some reading, because you never know what's on the
list. Today we get a second opinion. We don't do that.
Okay, nachon. Yeah, that's true, because you're supposed to get somebody who knows what you're talking about. Based on this premise, he says, this introduction, lo nischayev mibnei godol ma'alat chachmei ha-talmud u'tchunatam. Okay, we are not obligated even in light of the great of the tremendous stature of the rabbis of the Talmud and their absolute perfection, the quality, absolute quality, and unimpugned perfection of their knowledge. Beferish haTorah uvedikdukeha v'yosher amareha bibur klala ufrateha. Just because Chazal are the only authority and the absolute experts in everything that has to do with the, everything down to the last leader's detail in terms of halacha, shenit an lahem v'namid datam becholim reihem birfuot v'chokmat teva v'atchuna. Doesn't mean that just because that they're the only experts. That's not the, they are the experts. They are the only authority and the only authorized people in terms of halacha that we have to say that everything they said with regard to medicine and science and tchuna is astronomy is also true. Ulaha minotam kasher na minotam, and we have to do it, that we have to believe them as we do have to believe them. Beferish haTorah shetachlit chokhmata biadam. They have absolute unimpugned mastery and authority over the Torah, finished. If you say anything about that, then you're not Pekaris.
Is that like infallibility?
When it comes to the authority of Chazal in terms of interpretation of Torah, yes, they're infallible.
I mean, that's a general opinion. I mean,
I don't think anybody disagrees with that. Right. Who else are you going to go to? I mean, the Talmud department, some place, university, where are you going to go?
So there's an issue, let's say, yeah. Hard death.
Well, let me finish. V'lahem nimsera lahorotam livnei adam. And then he goes on, he says, because there's a mitzvah, vasita lo tasor, vasita. Okay, so when we're talking about science, your question with regard to death is something else. That's the question of given that there are so many different, there's a, such a complex position. Such a complexity of issues and variables and around the question of the definition of death. How now will halacha evaluate those circumstances in light of the changeless rules and the Masara Torah Sheval Peh that we have in terms of the Gemara? That's a different question.
Because they're using sources.
So the question then becomes, so that's what I understand.
Why use sources from thousands of years ago?
Because legal principles transcend any one particular situation. We don't walk around. What? So the only reason, the only way the halacha can work is if we're still walking around on horses and cows.
If I need to
evaluate two cars that have a head-on collision, okay, or a car never hits a kid, or a car hits my dog. Whatever the case might be. So if the car did it. So I have to evaluate, okay, what are the principles of responsibility vis-a-vis the cow, vis-a-vis the bull, vis-a-vis a car? You evaluate the situation. You take the same legal sources. You evaluate them. You evaluate the reality changes. The circumstances that stimulate the legal discussion might change, but the principles don't change. The question of application, exactly. The question of whether brainstem death is a definition of death, even if there is cardiopulmonary activity, is a question of where is the interface between what I know is the formal law and what I see as the reality on the ground. That's where the machlokas is. Okay, those who say the Gemara says the definition of the death is the cessation of cardiopulmonary activity. Very nice. Okay. So now the question is, okay, so what's the issue? If the person is still living on health life support, they're still breathing. What does it matter if they're being given help to do it or not? They're still alive. Or no? If the person could not possibly live on their own because their brainstem is what determines and what regulates cardiac and pulmonary activity, so that's already death. That's a whole other ballgame. That's the application of eternal principles to a changing reality.
So also the devil's advocate, the feminist issue.
Go to what?
Things that they want to utilize today in terms of the different status of women.
That's less easy to quantify than
what you just read us is we can ignore.
No, we're talking about science. Okay, and not everybody has the right to an opinion. I mean, that's the other thing. I'm writing all this, but it's like my wife always likes to tell the story that I was always jealous that I would go to the Rav for Shilas and I'd get the answer, do what you want. Do what you think is right. And I would never get mad at these friends. They used to get the I have a friend who got a notebook foolish, and I used to get do what you think is right. And I get really frustrated. And my wife said, you don't say he's giving you a compliment. So the issue here is something else. The issue here is who has the right to an opinion. We're going to talk about that, well, I guess, next time. The question is A, who has the right to an opinion? B, when it comes to issues of
sociology,
that's exactly the point. When it comes to issues of sociology, it's not an easy call. Okay, it's really not an easy call. Sometimes sociology has a standing. Sometimes it doesn't. I have a I personally think that it is also a question of motivation. So for example, I am under impressed in the whole debate about the Kotel and everything else with the way in which the arguments are constantly cast. They're constantly cast in terms of egalitarianism, in case of women's rights, and I have a right to do this, and I have a right to do that, and I can do this, and I can do that. That, what God might want, and we have 3,000 years worth of tradition to check it out, is, you know, we've lived in all kinds, I mean, the sociologically, France was not the same as Germany in the Middle Ages, and that was not the same as Poland, not the same as Italy in the Renaissance, not the same as Spain under the Muslims, not the same as Spain under the, we've lived in all kinds of different circumstances. There are certain, you know, there's certain constants that you have, and nobody pays attention to that, number one. Number two, there's an egocentrism, which I find to be incredibly offensive on the part of the Haredim too, by the way. I have heard no one, really nobody, get up and say, I want to be able to daven the way I want, because I feel that that's what my Avodas Hashem demands. Those words I have not heard, and I've read a lot of what's been said. Nobody says, this is my Avodas Hashem, I must do this way because I feel that God wants me to do that. That I haven't heard that. So that to me seems it's narcissistic. Not on the part of all. I'm not at all denying that it's a lot of sincerity there. In the same way that I think that those who say a woman who out of Avodas Hashem wants to put on a talis, that's some kind of and the talis is designed for women and so on, that's by definition possible. You know, that is also disrespectful. Sociology, yeah, no. I mean, it's like the women rabbi thing also. You have a situation in which, I mean, I'm not, there's no big Kiddush. In a wonderful book, by the way, which I recommend to everybody, Rav Chaim Sabato wrote an amazing presentation of conversations he had with Rav Ryan Lichtenstein. And Rav Ryan Lichtenstein, if there's anybody who's an onav, I said, a gadol b'Torah, forget about it. It's mind-boggling. But beyond that, a person who has a profound sense of Avodas Hashem, and is certainly not a radical, he says in one place, you know, we have thousands of Baruch Hashem very learned women, and there has to be some kind of context in which they can function. Now it'll be as I remember, and how it'll look, it'll probably look exactly the way from my friend Professor David Berger once put it. We were at this in 1988. Zolan Hammer is still alive. Zolan Hammer came to America, and he wanted to meet with the leadership of the modern Orthodox community in the greater New York area. And it was an amazing weekend. We went to the Jackson Hotel. I don't know if it still exists. It was a dump then. I'm sure it's still a dump. If it still exists. But it was really, but didn't, but the Gashmias didn't matter. It was amazing. And the representation of people there was like incredible. So a woman who was rather friendly got up and was complaining about the fact that she can't stand living, working, being in a mechitza because she feels like it symbolizes her role as a Jewish woman to live in a box. And she says, I don't want to be in a box anymore. And David Berger got up and he said, I hear your pain. I am sure that there's much more that can be done. but I don't know if that will satisfy you. And that's where it's going to be. Okay? But the thing is that we live in a situation in which, in a world in which sociology all of a sudden, well, whatever the passing fancy is, that becomes terus luxuriamus, as my Bobby would say. And that's it. That doesn't work. There has to be integrity to Masora. So where exactly, what applies when? That's the interesting question. So for example, on the question of, it relates, for example, to the Rub's famous report of the applicability of the principle that a woman will settle for anything or anyone as long as she can just be married. Tabla Mesav Tandum and Mesav Armalu. The Rav says that's a metaphysical reality. That's a halacha. That's not something that's going to change sociologically. It's nothing to do with women's situation in antiquity and so on and so forth. In fact, so when do you have chazakas like that? When do you have others? Others that we assume don't apply anymore. That's much more difficult to engage. I don't mean to in every case has to be taken on its own stage. One thing I will tell you is that because in the especially in the age of the internet, there's no hevum metum adin. You don't have a chance. You don't have a chance. In fact, one of the things I want to further. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I am categorically opposed to internet childless and chuvas and SMS chuvas. I can't imagine a greater, and I know people who do it, and some of them I really hold in very high regard. I find it an absolute aberration. I find it unless it's somebody's going to drop dead right now, you have to pass it on the spot. But I find it absolutely. I can't imagine an inversion of responsible psychalacha more than that. I find it crazy making. So take a look here. So in any event, so it's Talmud al Yori Elin Ked Natal Riad Rishus Me Rabo. So the smicha that we have today is simply Natilus Rishus Me Rabo. Okay, now the truth of the matter is that when that's the way it worked forever and ever. In the 14th century, there was a novelty that was introduced by whether he did it or whether he advanced it is some question. A man named Baruch Halevi of Vienna, in the wake of certainly after the Black Plague, when millions of hundreds of thousands of Jews were murdered and or died in the plague, whatever the case may be, you know, the Christians thought that some of the Jews died just to show that we died too because we were the ones who were responsible. Another story. Ramiro Levi said we need to have quality control because there were all kinds of people who were poskening shabbos acting like rabbis. They didn't know anything. So he says nobody can be a rabbi until they come and get prepared by me. Now up until that point, the authority, the ability to be able to function as a rav, as a teacher, as a moral rav was dependent. No, you studied with your teacher, and the teacher gave you permission. He gave you some kind of askam and goodbye. It seems to have been somewhat more formalized in Spain. There's in the 11th century collection called Sefer Hashtaros. Rabbi Yehuda of Barcelona has a long discussion about some kind of a shtar they would give to the guys who graduated from yeshiva. But in general, certainly in Ashkenaz, it was very, very informal. He was the one who started formalizing this. There was a huge fight in the late 14th century between the chief rabbi of Paris, Rabbi Yochanan Treves, about whom I just turned in an article to publication in Sidra, and another guy who had this fancy smicha. And Yochanan Treves said, "When my father was the chief rabbi, I got smicha from the world. What's your problem?" And there's enormous whatever, and the fight kept going on until the Jews were thrown out of France in 1394, and then it was really irrelevant. In any event. The whole start of this, I don't have to have rishus from my Rebbe, but rather from, you know, somebody else, but at least I have to be certified, that's where the present day smicha goes from. Now, so, let's go to the, so I will skip the rush, I just want to take a look at number four. Asal adam laharos lefnei rabba la'olam, Shulchan Aruch quotes the Gemara, and Simon Reish Membeis Nef Dalet, you never ever paskin in front of your Rebbe. And if you do so, you really deserve to die.
Out of kavod to him? Or the idea that he may know more. I mean,
gam v'gam. But it's years of kavod. If you have a teacher who's a who's your real Rebbe, why would you think to do that? I mean,
well, it's maybe an area that you actually know more.
So you defer to him and you say, I have the situation, you consult at the very least. Okay. But it doesn't mean you kill him. It means it means
Hashem. Yeah, yeah. Or does it mean just it's a bad thing?
No. Really it's a bad thing Chayav Misa means that he deserves, the person deserves to die. I mean that's how serious it is. Look at there were three functions of punishment. Penal systems have three functions. One, punishment. Two, deterrence. Three, a statement as to the severity of the infraction. And that might be the most important. So, for example, when they went and they decided that they wanted to... Actually, in Israel, they've had two. One has happened, one has not happened. When they say they want to decriminalize so-called soft drugs, what does that mean? It doesn't mean they make it okay. It's not going to be like in Holland, by the way. In Holland, it's not legal for the locals. It's only legal for the tourists, okay, I didn't know this. What happened was I gave a series of lectures in Leiden a couple of years ago, and I'm walking around at night, whatever. And I said, I see that every single store sells sticks. What are sticks? So I asked the person who was hosting me, oh, those are marijuana cigarettes, but you're only tourists are allowed to buy them, not local people. So, but anyways, they didn't want to say it was mutter.
The locals befriended.
They wanted to make it a misdemeanor. Why? It's still legal. But they wanted to make a statement about the severity of the infraction. The exact same thing happened. Sexual harassment was never allowed. It was never a mitzvah. It was never permitted. But by criminalizing it, they made a statement about its severity.
Could Min Rabba also the mara the atra of a place? Could be,
that's a good question. That could be.
Which would mean it sound like this: no one could bask him outside.
So that's the question. There is some question with regard to that, especially if you don't. I put it this way. Certainly I wouldn't. I don't think anybody in the town would paskin on a question of wouldn't paskin the Erev, I wouldn't give a heksher in the town. I mean, to paskin a Shiloh or Shabbos, I don't think that's. If within 3 parsangs, not 3 miles, let's say, of your Rebbe, you're not allowed to paskin. Imhu Rabba Mufak. Interesting, Shiloh, I was just asking about if you got Rishus. If you didn't get Rishus. There were all kinds of, the Lower East Side was loaded with Talmidim of Rav Moshe who had a paskin occasionally, whatever.
Maybe this is implied today. Like when it could be.
Well, then the question is: at one point you have that could be, but the question is: at what is there such a thing today either? Because nobody is more than a second away than a send button from anywhere. So that's a whole other ball game. Okay, now, so you're not allowed to unless you unless you get reshus and so on. Okay, yes, that. Number four. The Chidor, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai, one of the more colorful figures in Jewish history, writes as follows in the Bircha Yosef. Asur la adam la horos lefnei rabo. Yafeh. Okay, he quotes this again. He says, Yeshli yizahir la ayen basfarim kodem sheyore. You just got to look it up. Don't just paskin off the top of your head. You have to look it up in Sfarim. Velo yismo chal rashum bizichrono, and don't rely on what you remember, because a lot of people remember what things that aren't written, or they don't remember well, or they get confused. Va'amru shamore ba'al peh be'ein poseach sefer shelefanav karov li kares besug mora halacha b'shem rabba. He quotes the Shavus Yaakov, the Rabbi Yaakov Reisher. He says, and that's who, by the way, is we'll see in a second, that's quoted in the Pesachei Tshuva too. Because that's who you, first of all, Halpidin, most of what you learn is from books. In the old days, when you had an entire Masor from your Rebbe, and you knew everything, and everything was on Baal Peh, of course, he was your source. But most of what we know is from books, so at the very least, I mean, I don't think he means it technically, but literally, but certainly you should look it up.
When is he writing this?
He's writing this 18th century. Same thing is quoted in Pesachei Tshuva in Yoredeia. He says, quotes the Shavuos to say Shavuos Yaakov, Shekasa delachen roi lecho mi shigia lo horo shelo yorishom horo bilti iyun tchila b'sefer. Ki raboseinu hein hein asfarim ashen ispashtu b'ra b'kerav Yisrael. Usmach ledavar, and then he has a raya. It's not just that. You need to be able to sit there and think it through. You'll see things. You'll see how it's actually written. You'll give it some thought. You'll look at the person. There's a famous, a wonderful actually. There's a wonderful a letter. The Chazon Ish has a letter in the first chelik of the Igros Chazon Ish. I think it's Lamed Vav, Lamed Zayin, in which somebody asks him, "How do you paskin shilas?" He says, "Well, first of all, you got to do your homework. You got to sit down. You got to figure out what are the various sides of the din and how what are the various variables and how would it might work out this way, might work out that way. After your homework, and lay it all out." And then you got to look at the reality, and that's even harder than the theory. The theory is simple. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's difficult to. I don't understand why Rosh Yeshiva Paskin Shilas. They live in a theoretical world. You know, they may have it in for Rabbonim the way that theoretical physicists have it in for applied physicists. But at the end of the day, the applied physicists are the one who send the rockets to the moon, and not the theoreticians. The same thing over here. So you have to think it through, and then you got to apply it. You look at the person in front of you. Have a mesunim badin, by the way. They say mesunim badin vizdin. Like someone in the portion say, you're paskening on a person. You're not just paskening stam developer, right? It's a person who's asking you a question, and what are the possibilities, and what's legitimate, and what's not legitimate. It's one of the reasons why I can't understand this SMS thing. How do you know what you remember? How do you know what there is? You can't.
This flexibility in halacha, imagine that one person is far and one's asking that.
No.
It's a Hilchos Shabbos question.
So?
And somehow, there'll be a different answer, as if it's not like a truth related to the Shabbos, but it's based on...
Okay, well, first of all, now you're asking the question whether there's one halakhic truth or whether there's more. That's all question of machlokas, and there's all kinds of variations. There's one, the Sephardic position seems to be that there's one truth and it's true for everybody. The Ashkenazic truth seems to be a multiple truth system. Reb Moshe has someplace in the middle. He says it might be there's one truth in heaven, but all we have is the Emes LaHorah right now. That seems to be the middle ground. Reb Moshe says it's a number of his tshuvas. So my student Rabbi Yehuda Sussman is actually just did his master's on this, and now he's expanding it. That was Reb Moshe's position. You do the best you can, you know, but you have to be rebbeisha. But still, the point is over here that you can't. You've got to look at the person in the eye. And you know what? And looking in the eye, you never know what it's going to be. There are sometimes that you have to be mako. Sometimes you could be mako, but you know what? The person wants the chumra. So the person wants the chumra. Let them be chumra. You can't this business about whatever. So the rabbi used to say, if you got a phone call, I don't care if you know if you're a day up and down and all around and saying with nickels, say I'll call you back. There's no such thing, because once you say it's too late. Once you say it's too late, and it's irresponsible to yourself, to the person who asks you, and to the Torah, which is one of the and this last thing we'll do today. I just wanted to point out this. We'll start with this Gemara next week. It's a shame. This Gemara is Amar Rabbi Abba by Rav Huna Amar Rav. My diktiv. What does it mean? It's a pasuk that says Ki Rabim Chalim Hipila. For many are those who have been laid dead, and Atumim Kala Urgeha. And all of those who died are even greater. Ki Rabim Chalim Hipila. A lot of people have been killed. Zet Talmid Shelo Higila Horo Amor. This person is unqualified to Paskan Shilas, and he's our teach or whatever, and he does it anyways. Atumim Kala Harugeha. But even greater are the people who have been laid low and have been destroyed. Zet Talmud Shehigilo Ravein Omar, a person who's too deferential, he's too diffident, he has the tools and he won't share them, such a person is even more destructive. Why such violent language? It's very violent. So I think the answer is, I've never seen anybody talk about this, but that doesn't mean that there isn't, I just didn't see. One of the things that people who dabble in halacha don't understand that in a certain sense, no, I'm not sure that's in a real sense, a rav who paskins a shaila is like a doctor giving a prescription, except the implications are greater, because the doctor gives the wrong prescription, alright, so the person might get sick, the person might die, but if the rav gives the wrong prescription, the soul of the person is at stake. I'm not saying that the rabbis are more important than doctors. My point is that I think that that's the reason for why the Gemara talks in such extreme form. Because it's not just stam, oh, I made a mistake, the person ate treif. you hurt that person's neshama. That is no less important than their physical health. And that will understand that will that, and that will understand why an unlicensed practitioner is Rabim Chalim Hipila, and why the expert who refuses to practice is Atumim Kol HaRugah. All right, we didn't get all that far today, but we will continue Mitzvah next week.